It's a complete joy to be back with you for class two of Turning Poison into Nectar, practicing with the energy of shadow. So I just want to say I've been tremendously moved and excited by everything that's coming in on the listserv and some of the sharings that are coming in privately, and it's also what I'm experiencing myself, knowing that behind what you guys are speaking about, a lot more is occurring as well. I've been having a lot of interesting dreams myself, and along with that, a very powerful feeling of what I can only call sacred energy, realizing, as I always do when we work with shadow in a context like this, in an energy vortex like this, that shadow work is profoundly sacred. It's one of the truly great practices for self-knowledge and also for evolutionary consciousness transformation, because of course when we do this work ourselves, we're not just doing it for ourselves, we're doing it for our families, we're doing it for our partners, we're doing it for our friends, and ultimately we're doing it for the cosmos itself. So, lest we doubt that there's a lot of energy tied up in shadow, we only have to notice the sense of freedom that begins to move through us as we give ourselves permission to look into this material, even if and when it's painful, as of course it sometimes is. I'm very interested actually to see how this is happening with so many of you, often through recognizing shadow substances, as it were, that we've hidden because they felt bad, or just really noticing what's going on in our dreams, noticing the signs and symbols of shadow that come up in dreams. And of course, we've also come up against some of those basic questions that arise, especially for people on a yogic journey. Why not simply behave better, improve our attitudes, cultivate virtues? You know, it's always the great issue with shadow work. Why do we need to look at this stuff? And of course, these are really good questions, because the fact that we're working with shadow doesn't really get us off the hook of ethics or recognizing that we need to be the best friend, parent, partner we can be. But of course, the answer to it is that when we don't recognize our own shadow material, it's much harder to offer our best to the world. Because of course, when shadow is unseen, it's going to get expressed one way or the other, whether in secrets, getting irritable for no reason, and so many other behaviors. And I would also like to say, as we leap into today, that there is a certain, let's say, measure in working with shadow, measure in the old-fashioned sense of the word. In other words, we don't deny ourselves access to our shadow or shadow material. We recognize that if we don't look at it, it's going to blindside us in all sorts of ways. And we also realize that we'll never be genuinely authentic unless we're able to integrate these shadow parts. But on the other hand, we don't want to get so fascinated by it that we get lost in our shadow material, that we wallow in it, that we start to get taken out by it. The same is true about the golden shadow. When we deny it, we feel crippled and half alive, and we're not able to really make space for what's sometimes called the emergent, the evolved self that's wanting to come forward in every single one of us. But it's also true that, as Herr Jung often says, we don't want to inflate ourselves with the feelings of omnipotence that will often begin to show up, certainly in my experience, when we first start to recognize how powerful that golden part of us really can be. So that said, it's in shadow work that we really, really see the value of holding witness practice, access to that part of us that can compassionately hold both sides of our nature, indeed all sides of our nature. And it's also valuable, and this is part of what I hope we are being to each other here, it's also incredibly valuable to have some people in your life who can see your shadow, both sides of your shadow. Hopefully they'll be compassionate friends, But I have to say that in my life, it's often the uncompassionate frenemies who are really good at pointing out my dark side, my shadow side. And over the years, I've found that as I learned to see my own shadow with a certain clarity and compassion, it's a lot easier to take that kind of feedback without sort of refusing it or feeling bad about it. And you will also, I hope, as we all must, if we are to live through this profoundly interactive process of evolving consciousness, have people in your life who can look at you and see the golden shadow, even when it hasn't fully emerged. When another person sees the beauty in you, it makes it that much easier to see it in yourself. And best of all, of course, is to have people in our lives who can see both, who can hold the hidden beauty that we may not want to own, and also hold the shadow and love us. So, as I was talking to one of my friends about this week, she was telling me a story that I want to share with you, and then we'll chant. So one way to discover some of the hidden parts of your shadow, as some of you know, is to ask people who know you well to tell you what they see as your unseen selves. And again, you want to ask them to look at both sides, and you want to ask them to be honest. But this story, this tale that my friend Sarah, which is not her real name in case there's anyone here named Sarah, this friend of mine, Sarah, was telling me, is that when she was in college, she read her boyfriend's diary. Always a bad idea. They'd been fighting a lot, and she wanted to find out what he really thought, and she found this passage in the diary where he said, "Sarah says I'm judgmental and unavailable." And she used the word condescending last night. "And what I didn't say," he wrote, "is that I think she's a total ego junkie, always needing reassurance." It's the kind of thing you're likely to find in your college boyfriend's diary. That's why we don't read other people's diaries. But in this case, Sarah said it was incredibly illuminating to her. She was hurt by it. But she also realized what he was talking about. That he'd actually put his finger on a narcissistic quality about her that manifested as a constant need for approval. And one result of seeing this is that she actually began to monitor it and try to give herself that approval. A long time process, as we know, with all our shadow qualities. The point being that whether or not you have people in your life who can help you own shadow compassionately, you do have the power to do it yourself. And what I hope you're discovering during this class, many of you, of course, have been discovering it for years, is that you can trust that, because that divine witness in you does know all parts of you and can hold them together. And what this practice, this work, does at its best is to show us that in the heart of even the most unacceptable quality, there's a kernel of alive energy, of living Shakti, that can actually help you heal the shadow by accepting, integrating, and letting it reveal its unconscious gifts. And we'll be getting to that later in the class tonight. So it's one reason why the commitment to shadow work is so important, because the truth is, every time you bring a negative polarity into consciousness, I can swear to you it's a sign that the positive core of it is ready to be activated. So let me say that again. When you bring to consciousness a negative shadow quality, a negative polarity of your shadow, it's a sign that the positive core of it is ready to be activated. So it's in that process of holding and witnessing, seeing all the ways that we work with it, wholeness happens, and basic goodness starts to reveal itself as that part of you that not only can transcend and includes all sides of yourself, but which is actually able to hold the bright and the dark together, as part of the, let's say, divine recipe that makes us the tasty dish that we are. So let's chat and offer our practice, and then we'll start our first meditation and then go deeper into the experience that we've been having of working with the shadow. So you can begin by finding yourself a comfortable, upright, steady meditation posture, breathing in and letting your sit bones ground, and exhaling, allowing the torso to rise up through the crown. You can allow the chest to lift and open. You can, this is a really good idea when you're doing shadow work, feel that there's a grounding cord that is attached to the base of your spine and that is floating down, flowing down into the floor, into all the parts of the building if you're on a high floor, through the foundation, into the bedrock, down into the earth. And let that grounding cord sink down into the earth, grow down into the earth, and then spread out like the roots of a very, very deeply rooted and ancient tree, a great oak, roots spreading through the ground. And with that sense of rootedness, you can feel the energy in your lower body, the energy at the base of your spine, rising up through the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel, in the center of the body, finding itself in the heart. And you can begin to feel the breath flowing in and out horizontally through the heart. With that awareness, with that sense of being present in the heart, we'll chant the mantras with the help of Krishna Das, and then we'll make our offering. Okay, Krishna Das doesn't feel like singing tonight, so we'll sing together. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Om. We offer our practice, asking that through the power of our practice, all beings may have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask, may all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May they know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. May we have equanimity beyond positive and negative, beyond hatred, grasping, and dullness. And may we experience the equality of all that lives. And having offered our practice for the benefit of all beings, we ask for the grace of our true self, our essence, the divine energy which unfolds constantly within us. We ask that the enlightening force of the universe surround us, infuse us, protect us, that the light of truth penetrate any confusion. We ask that the pure fire of awareness and love hold space for us to see, to know, to accept, to let go, to integrate whatever in us may obstruct our journey. And we do all this for the benefit of all beings. Your awareness is flowing through the heart. And as the breath flows in, you feel its touch. Feel how its touch opens the energy, the spaciousness inside the heart center. Noticing that if in fact your heart feels contracted or hard or swampy or emotional, that you can let the breath offer itself into the heart as a loving, soothing, nourishing, life-giving, gentle force. The breath is offering you the subtlest touch of love and energy. And with the exhalation, you can begin to feel that love and energy moving through the center of your body, moving through the back of the heart, so that your attention comes into the area of your back heart. And with the next inhalation and exhalation, you begin to sense that softening and opening in the back of the heart. The breath flowing through the back of the heart and opening up for you the spacious presence at your back. And you allow yourself, as the breath flows into the heart, through the back of the heart into this presence behind you, you allow yourself to take the support of that wider, vaster, loving presence of the Great Heart, which is always there supporting you. And your simple attention to the breath becomes a recognition of the breath as a current or a tide that flows into your heart, flows out through the back of the heart, opens up into the back heart, and then sends another tide, a subtle tide of love and awareness from the Great Heart through your body. Just let yourself receive it, receiving the in-breath, letting it flow through the back of the body, and receiving with the exhalation the gift of that Great Heart presence. And of course, if thoughts are arising, if they are distracting, name the thought, and just allow it to be carried with the breath into the back heart. And allow the Shakti, the energy of the Great Heart, to infuse your body with the exhalation. and you can open your eyes or not. I know that some of you who take my classes go into a kind of a semi-meditative state at the beginning, and then you have to listen to the download in order to find out what happened. So just know that if that's the case with you, I will periodically suggest that you wake up, but also know that whatever is happening, you're assimilating some of this transformative energy, even in your semi-meditative state. Carl Jung used to say, and I've always found this really resonant, that shadow issues are a problem of morality. And of course, he was writing in the early 20th century when this was a very big deal, and it was about to become a bigger deal, cascading into the way it is today. He wrote, "The individual who wishes to have an answer to the problem of evil has need first and foremost of self-knowledge, that is, the utmost possible knowledge of his own wholeness. He must know relentlessly how much good he can do and what crimes he is capable of, and must beware of regarding one as real and the other as illusion. Both are elements within his nature, and both are bound to come to light in her should she wish, as she ought, to live without self-deception or self-delusion." And Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian novelist, wrote something similar. He said, "If there were only evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and if it were only necessary to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them, but the line dividing good and evil runs through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart?" To which I say, hopefully not us. As some of you know, and this I think is a true cosmic coincidence, today is the beginning of the Indian festival of Navaratri, the 9 nights celebrating the warrior goddess Durga. And during Durga, which is a really big festival in India, and in the Indian diaspora and the rest of the world, devotees chant, they recite a long ballad called the Devi Mahatmyam that describes the goddesses, the Devis, battles with 3 sets of demons, dark force energies who are oppressing the world. It's a straight up tale of light versus dark, which of course as practitioners we interpret in terms of our own inner practice. That is to say, the dark force is representing the ignorance in us, and the light force is representing that in us which dispels the darkness, not so much by fighting as by turning on the light. But this is a battle story. And in one of these stories, there's my favorite moment, one of my favorite moments in mythology, when Durga, the warrior goddess, who's been asked by the gods, the light forces, to rescue the world from a demon who can only be killed by a woman. She's promised to fight these demons single-handedly, and they have sent armies of demonic forces against her. I mean, literally hosts and hosts of monstrous, incredibly skillful, cunning demon warriors. And in the midst of a battle, one of the moments in the battle, Durga opens her mouth, and from within her emerges a host of goddesses. Some of them are very beautiful, very sweet. They're the consorts of the gods, the shaktis, the powers of the gods. Others are really scary looking, with fangs and sharp teeth and claws, and they all have weapons. Some of the weapons are obviously weapons. Some of the goddesses carry weapons that don't look like weapons. For example, the goddess Saraswati carries a water bowl, the kind of bowl a monk carries, and she keeps sprinkling drops of water from her bowl on the demons, but the water dissolves the demons. It's kind of like celestial napalm. And the goddesses among them just finish off the demon army, and then the 2 chief demons challenge Durga. They say, "You promised to fight us alone, and look, you cheated, you had all these helpers." So the goddess says, "Not so. All of these are a part of me. All of these goddesses, all these forces, all these Shaktis are a part of me. So there are a lot of ways to look at this story. I just finished writing a book about it, so I'm into it. But if you look at this story as a story of the psyche, what you see is that we're all in a sense run by committees. So some of the people on our committee, some of the selves on our committee are really soft, innocent, pure, loving, sophisticated, well-mannered. Some of them are rude, boisterous, shrill, strident, ugly, sad, wounded, and everything in between. But all of them are resources. And that's the thing. They're all resources. So just as the goddess calls on every aspect of herself in the battle with the dark forces in this mythic story, we call on every aspect of ourselves, the so-called light and the so-called dark in the project that the sages of Tantra call full self-recognition. So the self the sages ask us to recognize is the divine self, the all-inclusive self, the non-dual self. But to know that self, there's no help for it. We actually have to include all that's part of us. And until we do that, our intellectual ideas about inclusiveness and non-duality don't actually work. They break down. And that's actually why shadow work is so sacred. Because when we come up against those parts of us, which could be beautiful parts as well as not so beautiful, when we come up against those parts of us that we would reject or refuse to own, then the whole non-dual idea, the whole non-dual path kind of breaks down. So this week, we're going to continue looking at different ways that we can take our shadow out of the closet. And we're going to continue to sort of sidle up to her, to give him sidelong glances, and to be prepared to be surprised. When I first began doing shadow work, which was almost 20 years ago now, I had a dream, one of those dreams that a lot of you have been sharing, in which I saw a man, a kind of a goblin-like figure, who was walking around a restaurant, insidiously slipping a kind of Mickey Finn into people's drinks. And you know, Mickey Finn, it's like a drug that knocks people out. But in this case, this drug actually, it didn't knock people out, but it silenced them, so that they could no longer speak clearly or articulate well. And I was appalled by the presence of this guy in my dream, and I actually woke up and put myself back to sleep, which is a shadow work technique, to reenact it and make it come out better. So in the dream, in my reenactment of the dream, I grabbed this man, I tied him up, and I told him in no uncertain terms that he was doing a really bad thing. And I kind of came out of that feeling quite triumphant about having, you know, like taking care of him. And when I woke up, I realized that this character was a part of me that I knew very well. It was an inner voice, an interjected father voice, as they say in the psychological trade, that was constantly telling me that nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. And I'm sure that many of you know that voice. Many of us have it. In my case, it was clearly the inner voice of my beloved but judgmental father, who had lots of complex issues around women's roles, as men did in those days, and of course no longer do in our society. But he had basically valued my oldest brother's style of highly quick-witted intellectual brilliance, which was kind of like his, and condescended to my more intuitive way of sorting reality. So I felt that I'd really seen something important, a big core wound. And later in the day, I very excitedly told the dream to a friend of mine, and she said, "Wow, you know, that is exactly how you make me feel. When I'm around you, I feel silenced. I don't feel like I can talk." And that was so powerful for me. I realized how the inner voice, that character that, you know, that persecutes you, that you experience as one of your own shadow selves, is actually a perpetrator. So the one who condescended to me inwardly, also condescended to other people outwardly. And that was, you know, that's one of the deep insights we can see as we start to find negative shadow. They're being thrust out into the world and impacting others. And what I did, and I've offered you this practice, is I did some inquiry with this dude, and I asked him what he wanted, and he told me, actually very movingly, that he was afraid that other people wouldn't let him express his creativity, so he had to shut them up in order to give himself space. And it was actually this particular moment was quite life-changing for me. And as I think the process of dialoguing with your own negative shadows and positive shadows has been for some of you, you know, we're all victims of what Jung called our complexes. And I'll say more about that for those of you who don't have heard the word complex but don't quite relate to it. It's impossible to reject yourself without rejecting others. And of course, on the other side, it's impossible not to love others when we love ourselves. It's impossible not to love others when we love ourselves. So, what is it that shadow work asks for of us? It asks us to stop blaming other people. It asks us to take responsibility for our feelings and thoughts. It asks us to deepen our awareness, to recognize and hold paradox on so many levels, to open our hearts, to be willing to let go of our ideas about perfection, it's another big one, and to live in mystery. You know, the psyche is a mystery. There's so much more in us than we can see and more than we'll ever know. And the biggest mystery is that when we hold it in the right way, when we hold it in the mystery, then the mystery itself awakens and transforms us. And what I feel it means to hold the mystery in the right way is, first of all, to keep on trying to work with it, not just throw up our hands and say, who me or what can I do? To keep on trying to sort it out even when it feels really confusing, while at the same time recognizing that it is not up to us to heal it. That consciousness herself, consciousness himself, heals itself. So, in this gesture that we've been working with last week and this week, you can close your eyes for a moment and just let yourself inhale in through the heart. Inhale into the back heart. Perhaps with the feeling of inhaling whatever quality in yourself that little story reminded you of, whatever it was, and letting it fall in with the breath into the spaciousness of the great heart behind you. And then let yourself breathe out spaciousness, light, awareness, tenderness out from the great heart through your body. So as you know, there are different ways that we get shadowed. And we have different types of shadow. We all participate, of course. We have our personal shadow, which is unique to us. See, that's one of the deep points about shadow. We have a unique shadow. Every one of us has our own shadow, which is kind of like the finished dish of the recipe that's gone into making us. But, of course, we're also part of the family, and this has been coming up a bit in the last few days. Every family has its own shadow, which affects us even if we rebel against it. Even if we are convinced from earliest childhood that we were born into the wrong family, we are still holding the shadow of our family. As the poet Larry Thomas wrote, "The sons shaped their feet with the shoes of their fathers. To the plight of their mothers, the daughters surrendered their dreams." We just can't help doing that. So, you know, for example, I'm just going to give you a couple of probably fairly obvious examples. If you grow up in a family that considers money the main qualification for success, you'll carry that family belief, even if you spend your life trying to prove it wrong. I mean, for example, how many heirs and heiresses do you know who spend much of their lives trying to give away the family money? And yet, as some of my friends have discovered, when they don't have money, they feel actually more lost than someone who grew up poor. Because, you know, that belief that money is part of your soul that comes from having grown up with that particular family shadow, is just inherent in us. You know, or as Michelle wrote on the listserv, we may have the opposite attitude that we have to struggle for survival, that real abundance isn't possible for us when that's our family shadow. Or suppose your parents, like so many of my peers, were counterculture types, rebels from the middle class or hippies, and as the child of rebels, you might carry the repressed shadow of social conformity and do your best, as many of my friends' kids did, to live a respectable, orderly life, repressing the wildness that their parents lived out. And one of the interesting things that I see is that the generation known as the millennials, the young people who are now in their teens and 20s, many of whom were the children of political rebels of the 60s, are rediscovering that countercultural political activist quality, and in a certain sense carrying, let's call it, the activist shadow, which to me is a golden shadow, of their parents or even their grandparents' generation. So our family's shadow, of course, our families, again, this is not news, are the arena in which early wounding takes place. And your family, you might have been considered the pretty one while your sister is the smart one. Your mother may have been angry or depressed, and you've done everything you could not to be like her, and as a result never admitted to yourself that you have a core of depression. Or you might have been the family hero or the family scapegoat. You might have lost a parent and reacted to that by creating an inner shadow belief that you're not going to be loved or taken care of. You might have very critical parents or parents who indulged you so much that you deeply feel that there's something wrong with you, otherwise everybody wouldn't have to be so indulgent. You know, as Philip Larkin, the English poet, said, "They fuck us up, our mom and dad. They can't help it. They don't mean to." But the deep truth about family shadow, of course, and what makes it really complicated, is that very often our family shadow wounds are not really ours, but they're pain we're carrying from our parents or caregivers. There's a story by Ursula Le Guin about a city where she's a great science fiction writer, fantasy writer, marvelous fantasy writer, about a city where there is no sorrow, no poverty, and no ugliness. everybody is totally happy and successful. And there's a little boy in that city who's kept in a basement in the dark. And everyone knows he's there, but no one rescues him, because the pact that they've made in that city is that this one child will carry all the pain, sorrow, poverty, and ugliness for the whole city. Now that's a powerful story that, you know, has a lot of social implications. And it's certainly true for many of us, for most of us as children, because we take on the shadow and the unlived lives that our parents have repressed or can't handle or haven't lived. And that often happens not just with our parents, but with our peer groups. I have a friend who, and this is a classic, typical experience, who when he was in the third and fourth grade was smart and kind of unusual, unlike other kids, and he was completely ostracized in the playground in grade school. The other boys would call him a fag, which is, you know, in at that age level, it's often an all-purpose term for somebody who's different. And he carries to this day the shadow of being outcast. And in his adult life, he is often cast out of groups that he's been a part of. It's as though that shadow projects itself out and comes back to him. So it can be very helpful to feel your way into that original wound. But, of course, often just knowing about it or even going through a whole psychological process to find it is not quite enough. And, you know, for some of us, it's tremendously important. For some of us, necessary. But it's also possible, and that's part of what we're doing, to work with a lot of this by finding the core feeling, the emotion of the shadow feelings, even finding it in the body, and working with it through the great heart or through the practices of allowing consciousness itself, the psyche itself, to metabolize them, which is part of the grace of shadow work. So, again, let's breathe in and have the feeling this time that you're breathing in some of that one piece, let's say, one small piece of what you know to be the family shadow, whether it's the shadow of a parent who's angry or critical or sad, or the shadow of someone who's died, or the shadow of childhood bullying, or the shadow of the older brother who kept telling you you were a wimp because you were too small to keep up with him and his friends. Just one piece of that shadow, that wound, and just let yourself breathe it in and open up to the back heart. To the big heart, and allow yourself to offer that wound. You don't have to feel into it deeply, although of course you can. Allow yourself to offer that wound into the great heart. And then with the exhalation, feel that spaciousness, tenderness, light, the holding energy of the great heart just flows through your heart. And allows that wound or that memory or that shadow quality to be embraced. Breathing it into the great heart behind you and allowing then the spaciousness of the great heart to surround your body, to hold you, to hold this. And you're very, very welcome to continue doing this as I speak. This, of course, is the process that we began last week, which is the great Tibetan practice called Tonglen, or sending and taking, which is actually one of the most powerful and effective and profound ways of practicing the shadow emotions. And we're going to continue this practice as we enter into the second form of shadow that we're all part of, the collective shadow, which we know has power that we often don't realize, especially when we don't feel ourselves to be part of the, let's say, the mass shadow. But of course, every nation, every organization, every family has a collective shadow, and we all live it, even if we are, even if we don't approve of it. There's this old joke that I love about national stereotypes, and I'm going to tell it very quickly. It's about taking a trip with some of the members of four European nations, and the trip is heavenly or hellish, depending on who's in charge of what. So in the heavenly trip, the English are in charge of welcoming, the Germans are in charge of logistics, the Italians take care of the leisure activities, and the French are in charge of food. And in the hellish version, the French are in charge of welcoming, the Italians do logistics, the Germans are in charge of leisure activities, and the English are in charge of the food. Now, this is a completely unfair, stereotypical joke, of course, and it's, of course, as we, in our time, it's not just that no nation is completely in the throes of its collective stereotype, but the truth is that we all do partake in our collective shadow. You know, part of the shadow of American free enterprise is tendency to greediness, and the collective shadow of our egalitarianism. In my part of the world, say in the Occupy movement, is a good example, is a disallowing of excellence or leadership. The shadow of meritocracy is competition. The shadow of American openness to experience is a kind of strange combination of prurience and sexual puritanism. The shadow of many spiritual communities is the repression of negativity or eccentricity. So we all have traces of our collective shadow, just as we have of our family shadow, and part of the process of coming into our own is to differentiate our personal self from our collective self, without totally divorcing ourselves from participating in the collective. But what I want to say is that it's also very important to realize that, for example, anger, grief, and depression is not just personal, and it doesn't just come from your family. In other words, we are all suffering from the grief and depression and anger of the collective, of people all over the world, or of the grief and depression and anger that comes from, perhaps from the earth itself, from nature itself. And as we do our personal shadow work, it's also important to acknowledge that for many of us, especially people who are sensitive, as so many of you are, it's also important to acknowledge that our grief, our fear, our anger, etc., is not always, and in fact never is, entirely personal. And one of the great gifts of the practice of Tonglen is that it actually lets you see this. It lets you discover this. It lets you actually realize that what you take to be your fear, your anger, your wound, is not just yours. It actually partakes in the largeness of the collective. So we're going to do another practice of breathing into the great heart. And this time, I'd like to ask you to bring to mind something that's going on in this country or on the planet that deeply concerns you. It could be something about our current American political situation, if you're American. It could be the grief and oppression of girls in Pakistan that we've been reading about, hearing about in the news. Perhaps it's the pain of joblessness in some part of your state or your country. Or maybe it's the grief of seeing a forest that's attacked by oak moths or bark beetles because the climate's out of whack. So, just choose one and let yourself breathe in the grief, the anger, the fear, the anxiety, the pain, whatever combination or whatever feeling predominates. And breathe it in through the heart and into the great heart. Let it resolve itself into the spaciousness behind you. Feeling how the great heart holds and embraces that collective pain. And then feel that you breathe the energy, the spaciousness, the tender holding quality, the lovingness of the great heart back through your heart and into that situation. Let yourself breathe it in. And offer it back. Breathing it in. Using your own heart as a conduit to draw that pain or grief or anger or anxiety or fear into the back of your heart and letting it dissolve or be offered into the great heart. And each exhalation allows the flow of the great heart spaciousness to flow through your heart and into that place or that situation, into that tangle, into that area of shadow. It's your offering, the offering of the great heart through you. See, your awareness flows in through the heart, into the great heart, and the spacious energy of the great heart flows back into your heart, and back through your heart into the world. And you notice how your body feels. Notice how your emotional body feels. If there's something you want to write down, please feel free to write it down. We're going through a number of recognitions and practices about shadow in this class, and they're all practices that, as you can see, they're practices that we can expand and work with in many different ways and in many different situations as we metabolize family shadow, collective shadow, and also our own unique shadow. One of the great insights about unique shadow that actually is part of Jung's work and has been explored very much in the contemporary world by people who are really trying to work with different self-actualization processes, is that one of the ways in which our shadow uniquely gives us information, just as our essence uniquely gives us information, is by showing us the qualities and the aspects of ourselves which we are not fully living. So one of the deep reasons to do your shadow work is because when you really see certain aspects of shadow, you see parts of your essence, parts of your the life that you're meant to contribute, the thing that you're here to do, that you may have disowned or put on hold, perhaps because of family issues, perhaps because of other parts of your shadow. So our negative shadow, certain parts of our negative shadow, is really, really good at showing us qualities of our light, of our beauty, that we haven't fully lived out or owned. I'm going to give you an example of a friend of mine who's a professor. She's a great, great facilitator, and she comes from a generation who was taught that in teaching, especially in teaching seminars, the job of the teacher is not so much to lecture as to draw out knowledge from the students. And she's really good at this. She can actually bring a class alive and get people to understand things that they never realized they understood. She does it with this Socratic questioning method. But a few years ago, she noticed that she was having a lot of outbursts. You know, outbursts being a pretty clear sign that there's some shadow material being repressed. She'd say something incredibly nasty and sarcastic to a colleague, or she'd just blow up in a meeting, and railroad things through. And this was so contrary to her normal gracious behavior that other people in the faculty started talking to her about it. And she started to ask herself what was going on. And what she eventually realized was that her lifelong role as a facilitator was actually not allowing the space for the part of her that had strong opinions and that is passionate about politics, about literature, about spirituality. In other words, a big part of her essence was being denied by her belief and her training that it was more valuable to make space for other people than it was to take the space yourself. Now, those of us who have that issue probably recognize that some of that, you know, is major family stuff, but be that as it may, one way she realized what was happening was that she was co-teaching a class with a colleague, another woman who was very expressive and who had no problem just saying whatever she wanted in front of the class, who was incredibly popular and who, of course, because she was so expressive and so creative, was everybody's favorite teacher. And my friend noticed that she was getting angry at her friend, feeling very critical of her friend, and that she decided she didn't want to teach her there anymore. And, of course, when she looked at it, she realized that she was actually profoundly envious of her friend's assertiveness and creativity. And with a bit of self-inquiry and some work with her teacher, her spiritual teacher, she was able to recognize that her anger and jealousy of her friend was actually pointing her towards something that she needed to do herself, which is to say, and I'm sure many of you recognize it, just cop to her own, not only her own creativity, but her own desire to actually be the center of attention, to be recognized as special and smart, all that stuff that spiritual people, you know, think we're not supposed to want. But it was incredibly liberating for her. She's started a book. She created seminars for herself next year in which she lectures, and shares her passion on one of the subjects that she likes. And one sign that she's doing this shadow work is that she doesn't have outbursts in meetings anymore, and she's much less angry at her friend. So part of why I wanted to tell you this story is because one of the important aspects of shadow work is actually when you recognize a shadow behavior is also not just to leave it there, but to recognize an action that you can take that gives voice to the positive shadow that often lurks underneath the negative aspect. So finding a way to actualize the positive pull. And we're going to get into that also a little bit later. So this is a contemplation practice. This is a shadow contemplation practice. So if you have paper and pen or a computer, that's really good. Or you can just ask yourself the question. Consider for a moment someone or something, someone in your life that you're jealous of, that you're envious of. And it might be somebody that's, it might not be a current jealousy. It might, you know, it might be something you've resolved. But for most of us, there's somebody in your life, or maybe somebody in the world, that you envy. And one of the signs that you envy them, actually, is often that you're critical of them. So you might notice that if you're being extremely judgmental and critical about somebody who's part of your life or who's a public person, that it might be that you're jealous of one of their qualities. So I'm gonna talk a little bit more about that. Some of you are just getting it immediately, and some of you might be wondering how to find it. So first of all, if you look at what you envy in others, it points to your own shadow. It's nearly always the person you envy is someone like you. In other words, most of us don't envy Angelina Jolie, for example. But if you went to drama school with her, as someone I know did, and have a strong desire to be a well-known, successful actor, when you see Angelina's world fame, you might feel jealous, envious, sort of one down, and in the case of this person I know, quite critical. So it's the sign, the place to look is when someone has or achieves something that you sense is something that you meant to do, a job you meant to have, a creative project you're meant to do, something that's actually a piece of your golden shadow. And it, since those are the people that you envy, and that envy is always a pointer to a shadowed positive quality of yours. So as you see it, again, we're going to work with it with Tonglen, and then I'm going to ask you to take another step. So when you see that quality that you envy, again, imagine yourself breathing in that quality from this person. For example, if what you envy is someone's creativity, breathe it in through your heart. And this time, imagine it suffusing your body. Whether you kind of believe it or not, just imagine yourself taking in this quality from this person. And with the exhalation, feeling it suffuse your body. And it's often very interesting to give it a light. You know, so if what you're envying is a quality of reflectiveness or spiritual capacity, you might imagine it yourself breathing it in as this pale blue light and breathing it through your body. If what you're envying is an articulateness, a capacity for speaking, imagine it as a bright reddish gold vibrant quality and breathe it through your body. So notice if what you're breathing in has a color, and also see if you can feel whether it has an emotional tone, an energy. So as you breathe in this quality that you envy, and as you breathe it through your body, notice the energy that comes with it. Notice if there's resistance to it. Let yourself keep breathing it in and letting it suffuse your body. And what do you notice? I mean, maybe you notice that it kindles something. Maybe you notice that you knew this already and that you're being reminded of something that you've sensed. But what I'd like you to do now is actually consider a positive real world step that you could take that would help actualize this in your life. It can be a very, very small step. Something as simple as speaking up to somebody that you normally back down in front of, or giving yourself an extra 5 minutes to meditate, or buying yourself something that expresses this quality, or acting on taking a step towards actualizing a project that you know you're being called to do. Or just calling that person and having a nice conversation with them. And we're going to take just a couple minutes now, because I know I've been talking and we've been practicing, and see what came up for you in that exercise or one of the ones that we've just done. And if you do have something you want to say or a question you want to ask, you can press *7 and you'll be on the line. So if there's something you'd like to say or ask, press *7 and you're on. And this looks like Donna has something you want to say. Bhakti?
Hi, Sally.
Hi there.
If we have never been envious of someone, but actually this particular person, this thing that came up, someone who I dated was so free in her sexuality and felt so comfortable. She's the person that came up because I obviously, anyone who has read my post realized that I'm not like that. If I was never actually envious of her,
right, but
does that mean that my shadow is like even deeper than I thought?
No, it might just mean that this quality that you recognize in her, that you're drawn to in her, is a quality in yourself that you want to bring forth. So, no, envy is not the only sign. Envy is just one of the pointers. So, I would say that's a good thing to work with.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. If anyone else, and it doesn't have to be about envy, it could be about something that we've done in the course of this time together. Dick?
Hello?
Hello. Okay. Is this Chayek?
This is Sue Carpenter.
Oh, okay. Hi, Sue. There's
Hi. I'm new to I just joined this. And my question, what I noticed with my practices as we were going through this evening, and I have seen this in the past for myself, my mind gets very busy and it pulls me away. It creates confusion.
Right.
It's a very vata thing for me. And, and then it's challenging to know how to kind of get centered again, because when I bring in a question or an inquiry, then the mind will again get very
right. What comes
windy.
Up is confusion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's
yeah.
Yeah. So how to kind of, I guess, sit with the confusion
that.
And filter through it so that I can get back to the inquiry.
Yes. So what you would do is breathe in the confusion, and this is a really I just thank you for asking that question. In other words, instead of, because what happens when we get confused, we start asking
mm-hmm.
all these questions and talking, and as you're right, that all this vata energy, this mind energy, just kind of starts tossing us around. So draw it in, breathe it in, breathe it into the heart, and just offer it into the back heart, and allow that spacious energy in the back heart to flow through your body and into the confusion. And do it until there's a little bit of a sense of centeredness, and then bring up the question again. A lot of the time when we're working with a very active mentalogue, as one of my friends likes to call it, what we have to do is find a way neither to fight it nor to just give into it. And then this is one way to do that, that it actually means you fully accept it, and you just work with it. And I would suggest, Sue, that you just do that for a few minutes now, and we'll see where we are. And I'm going to take one more question from Dick.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, and let me know how it goes. So, Dick Waltz from Madison, Wisconsin, you are live. Hi.
I think, Sally, do I need to disconnect somehow? Because I'm Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, maybe it's you.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. So you're on, your phone is Dick Waltz. I get it. No, hang out. No, it's fine. It's fine. Just hang in there. So there's a couple of live mics. One that says Durango, Colorado, and one that says New York City. So, if one of you would like to speak, you have a moment to do so. And if you don't, I will assume that,
I have, Sally, this is Lalishri. I have a New York City area code. I'm not sure. Hi.
Hi.
I'm not sure how this works. Can I speak?
So I can hear you. Do you have something you want to say
okay.
or ask?
Thank you. So what comes up for me is, it was exciting as I was looking at the person that I look up to or envy, and just curious, when it comes to this shadow work, how does age and the number of years that we have been suppressing, you know, and working towards the light and unfolding that, how does that impact our ability to eventually shift all of this and be able to take greater strides or more visible, tangible strides towards the golden shadow? Like, does that have...
You mean, are you asking if you've had this for 45 years, it's harder to... open up to it than it's
yeah, easier. Like I'm 49, and sometimes I think, oh my God, you know, it's so much easier when you're in your 30s to move forward with your vision. I've been and am. I teach yoga and do other things as well, and so, and I'm clear that it's like there's almost this weightiness
of your year, of your karma,
confidence,
yeah,
of being able to finally just move forward with spontaneity, trusting in the inner wisdom that I've been accumulating and continue to study and hold.
Got it completely. So, Lalishri, just let me say, I'm 30 years older than you. And I know exactly what you're talking about. And I just, you know, my experience is that actually if you keep on doing these practices, it's not that you lose momentum and capacity, you actually gain it. There's an enormous amount of grace that you accumulate by not just by your yoga practice and your spiritual practice, but also by your intention. The thing is, when we're working with strong shadow karmas, it can seem for a long time as though we're not making any progress whatsoever. And then all of a sudden there's a shift, and that's how it works. It's a little bit like, it's a little bit like the pouring water into a glass, into a dirty glass. You pour and you pour and you pour, especially if it's a big glass. At a certain point, the clear water just takes over, and, the accumulation of small efforts will gradually give you the insight and also just the practice in really big transformation. So I would just say from my own experience that a lot of the big transformations in my life happened in my 40s, 50s, and 60s. So 39 is a baby.
No, I said 49, but that's okay. 49. 49. 49.
49,
yeah.
Yeah, 49 is like, in my life, 49 was late adolescence. I'm sure you're more mature than 49. But anyway, the answer is no worries. It's really, the thing about consciousness is consciousness so deeply wants to awaken us, to open us. And not just once, but over and over again on deeper and deeper levels. And what we're actually inviting, in these classes as we work with these different practices, because some of them are going to be more powerful for you in a given moment than others, is that consciousness herself, actually the mystery herself creates the transformation. And we're going to do one more practice, and I'll be sending you these, so not to overwhelm you with homework, not at all. And, you know, and I want to say that the homework all the homework is not obligatory. What I'm really interested in you doing is the one practice that I'm offering you as the main practice. And, or the meditation and contemplation practice. And then the others are there for you to try, because sometimes one feels more like the right thing for you, or you might want to, you know, you might have 15 minutes and just want to play around with it. So I'm really offering you a little menu that you can play with now. And also, as many people who do these teleconferences will attest, so that you have it 3 months from now when you suddenly are ready to do a piece of work or a piece of breakthrough and you realize that you have a couple of tools that you can do it with. So, you know, we've been seeing that when we react strongly to something that we see as negative, when we're very charged with something, it usually points to a quality in us that we're not fully seeing. And I think that many of you are having this experience. So the example, you know, someone was sharing with me recently was my friend who I told the story about earlier. She had done the practice last week of asking yourself, what are you really afraid to find out about yourself? And what she came up with was, I'm afraid of finding out I'm a narcissist. So I said to her, you're a narcissist. And she said, how can you say that to me? I said, no, it's an exercise. Say it, I'm a narcissist. So she said it, I'm a narcissist. I said, you're a narcissist. And she said, I'm a narcissist. And we went on like this for a little while, and then I asked, you know, when you do that, as you probably know, it takes a little of the charge out. But I asked her, okay, so what is the positive kernel of being a narcissist? What's the golden shadow of narcissism? And she thought for a minute. She said, I'm willing to look at myself. I'm willing to look into myself. And it was bingo for her. I mean, it's, you know, it's that quality of what you might call self-absorption or, you know, the quality that has a piece of narcissism in it. It also is, that's the shadow side of this capacity for actually working on yourself, looking into yourself. So the thing with shadow qualities is that they're always, always, they always contain a kernel of something that's profoundly positive and growth-producing. And the thing is, we're going to just look at some of these, and I'm going to ask you to work with one that strikes you. And if it's confusion and you're having a lot of thoughts and objections and resistances, then take that. You know, confusion and resistance are wonderful shadow qualities to work with, and they have positive sides to them, furthermore. So, this way of working with shadow, for example, if there's a quality that you really hate in somebody else, like, let's say, judgmentalness, or vindictiveness. So if you start to work with it and own that you actually, you know, even if you don't see it, you must have some of those qualities or else you wouldn't have so much charge with it. And you start to see little ways in which you're vindictive. And then, so that, you know, in this way, as we've been doing all week, what seemed to be opposite, somebody else's behavior and yours, are now united. But maybe you can also realize that if you can be vindictive, you must also have a strong sense of justice. And that this sense of justice, you know, which is a beautiful quality, it's the positive side of the kind of egoic, shadowy, you know, desire to strike at somebody, to hurt somebody, to take vengeance on somebody who's hurt you or someone else. So this way of working with the shadow is not the old yogic technique of pratipakshabhavana or practicing the opposite. Because, you know, the opposite of vindictiveness would be forgiveness, or the opposite of narcissism would be perhaps selflessness. But that isn't what we're looking for. We're actually looking to get access to the, let's say, the golden energetic core of this shadow quality, which, you know, might be the desire for justice or the, you know, in the case of guilt, for example, it might be conscientiousness. So, it's when we find the positive side, the positive aspect of the shadow, that we really start to experience integration and balance in the shadow. One really good example that's kind of up these days is the issue of keeping secrets, of secrecy, which, you know, gets so many politicians and public figures into trouble. So the positive aspect of secrecy, the positive quality of secrecy is privacy, you know, the capacity for confidentiality, for keeping some things private. So privacy isn't the opposite of secrecy. The opposite of secrecy would be disclosure, right? But privacy is a quality that lets us discern and balance the opposites of keeping secrets and disclosing everything. So I'm going to read a list of negative words. Isn't this delightful? I'll ask you not too long a list. I'll ask you to find the negative word that, you know, that kind of has charge for you. That you feel is something that you have a hard time with. And then I'm going to read some of the positive qualities of them, and then we'll do a little ceremony. So, for example, approval junkie. Are you an approval junkie? The positive quality of that is openness to being appreciated. Arrogance. I hate arrogant people. The positive quality in it is self-confidence. Being judgmental. Positive quality is discernment. Being bitter or holding grudges. Do you ever do that? Positive quality is refusing to overlook injustice. Being wimpy or wishy-washy. Positive quality in it is willingness to recognize other points of view. Being coercive. The positive kernel of it is being persuasive. Being manipulative. Being manipulative, the positive quality in being manipulative is getting things done. Being chaotic or disorderly or confused. The positive quality in it is being flexible and open. The quality of being helpless has a positive quality of being open to support. And negativity, which is for spiritual people, you know, one of the more undesirable qualities, the positive kernel of negativity is unwillingness to face unpleasant realities. So, choose one of the negative shadow qualities that you've owned in yourself. One that you're afraid to see or one of the ones on this list. And we're going to work with it in an active imagination. In an imaginative fire ritual. The fire ritual is one of the most ancient mediums of transformation. And in the Vedic fire rituals of India and in many other cultures, we offer to the fire sacred substances, mantras. We make vows in front of the fire. And fire is also the medium that transforms our negativities. So in this practice, we're going to offer this negative shadow quality into the fire, and then allow the fire to transmute it and offer us the golden kernel of it as a gift. So you can close your eyes and you may have made up your mind what you're going to practice with. You may also find that it changes in the course of the exercise, and that's fine. But it's good to have a strong sense of what it is that you want to offer. So you're sitting comfortably. You inhale and ground through the base and exhale and lift through the chest and upper torso. And you find yourself walking down a nighttime path. It's, again, a path in the forest. There are lights on the path that show you the way. And as you follow the path, you see the light of the sacred fire in an open space in front of you. A clearing in the forest, and in the middle of the clearing, within a fire pit surrounded by stones, protected by stones, is the sacred fire. You find yourself walking up to it. You may take a seat in front of it or stand gazing into it. As with all these imaginative exercises, it isn't necessary to do a strict visualization. You simply allow yourself to feel that you're in the presence of the energy of the sacred fire. And you may actually give yourself a moment or two to feel its heat, its light. See how deeply you can feel its presence. And now feel that this shadowy quality, and we're talking here about negative shadow, disowned shadow, this shadowy quality is covering you like a membrane or a cloak. Maybe a gray cloak or a black cloak, or maybe it has another color. And you sense the presence of this quality covering and surrounding your body. And you reach up and you pull this cloak, this membrane, which is very, very, it's both shadowy and very easy to detach. You pull it off your body, allow it to come off into your hands, and throw it into the fire. Place it in the fire. And if there are pieces of it still clinging, you can take them off. Just remove them, pull them off. If it feels that there are shadowy pieces clinging to your imaginary body, throw it into the fire. And feel that the fire receives it. Even if you haven't drawn off all the pieces of it, the fire is receiving it. And you may actually feel that other associated shadowy qualities also melt away as they're offered into the fire. And you stand in front of the fire. And you allow yourself to feel that this shadow quality, whatever it is, this fear-based, anger, grief-based, old shadow quality is merrily melting in the fire. And as you watch, as you look at the fire, you ask the fire, what is the gift that the transmutation of this quality makes possible? And now in your imagination, you see or feel or sense the being in the center of the fire, offering from within the fire, yet coolly. This is not the burning quality of fire. This is the subtle transformative quality of fire that arises out of the flames and offers to you a cup. Perhaps it's a golden goblet. Perhaps it's clear. But just see if you can feel this cup that's arises out of the fire. Imagine yourself taking it and holding it in your hand and sensing, if you can, the gift that's arising out of the transmutation of this shadow quality. Don't think too much about it. Just see if an image or a word or a feeling arises. And imagine yourself now drinking the liquid in the cup, or if it feels more natural inhaling it. So if you know what the quality is, or if you sense what the quality is, that's great. And if you don't, you're still inhaling the gift of the transmuted shadow quality. You're drinking the gift of the transmuted shadow quality. You're taking it into yourself. And as you sit in meditation, allow the fire to become a light and energy that flows with the breath into your heart and becomes a flame inside your heart. So you're actually drawing in the sacred fire, allowing it to be seated in the altar of your heart. So the breath now draws it in. Every breath is an offering into the flame in your heart. And with the exhalation, you allow that flame to expand and fill your heart. Thoughts are arising, offer them into the flame. If insights are arising, offer them into the flame. And just allow yourself to sit for as long as feels comfortable and possible and right. Inhaling into the flame that is now seated in your heart and allowing the light and warmth of the flame to flow through your being. Have a beautiful evening, a beautiful week.